Oh, people who identify as no religion pray, attend church, believe. Yeah, absolutely.
Welcome to The Political Animals. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole. I'm a scholar, writer, and translator specializing in political theology, the intersection between religion and politics. I'm joined by Dr. Ruth Powell, who is director of NCLS Research, that stands for National Church Life Survey. She's also an associate professor and research fellow at the Australian Center for Christianity and Culture at Charles Sturt University. And she is a sociologist of religion and the psychology of religion. And she joins me for a conversation about the demography of religion and spirituality in Australia. Ruth, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, oh, thanks for having me. It should be fun.
It should be. It will be. Okay, Ruth, why don't you kick us off with a bit of an overview of what NCLS is?
For sure, yes. In the 80s and 90s, the mission departments of Australian churches were observing that there were major changes happening in society. They'd watched the 60s and 70s come through. They'd seen huge social and cultural changes. And by the 80s, they were reflecting on how are we going to connect with our community better. And there was a whole move at that time of understanding the Missio Dei, the mission of God. And the missiologists and those who were the practitioners in mission were saying, we have to learn, we have to think about the same things as we did with cross-cultural mission when we were going overseas to other countries. And our learnings about global mission, we have to apply to our own backyard. So that was the context within which they said, in the same way that we have to learn about the culture, the context, the language of the people that we're trying to reach and serve with our gospel, we're going to need that to do that in Australia. And so NCLS research was born out of that desire to conduct mission research. And so our work right from 30 plus years ago is to basically describe the context. So we did that in a number of ways. We did that by using the national census that the government runs, ABS runs, and we still do that 30 years on. Every 5 years we're checking in, what can we learn about our community, our Australian society through the census? So that's part one. And then there was we need to listen to what people are saying, Australians are saying about God, about the church. And so we used our tools as sociologists to go, let's do surveys and listen to Australians. So there's another aspect, but that's the you can hear the driving force was we need to understand our context. So we still do, 30 years on, Australian community surveys, which give us a source of information about what Australians think about these matters. And then there was a moment where those mission departments, and it started in the Uniting Church and the Anglicans, who partnered in the Diocese of Sydney and New South Wales ACT Synod in the Uniting Church. Those two partners were working together and they said, how about we now listen to our churches so that we can make a connection between church and community? If we want to build a bridge between church and community, we need to understand our church. And there was a lot of stuff around global church growth literature coming from the US about, you know, what was going on. And there was a sense of, that's not Australia. We need to understand what the Australian church is like in our context. And this idea of this church life survey was born. It's going to be a local, you know, New South Wales venture. And there was what I would describe as a Kairos moment where, and I've still got the letter, where this partnership said, why don't we invite everybody? And this letter went out to every denomination in the country. And extraordinarily, within a matter of months, 20 Protestant denominations had signed up. Took the Catholics a little bit longer. They joined in next time we did it. But out of that, the National Church Life Survey was born. It's our biggest project that most people know our work by, this project of which we listen to all church attenders in churches and also leaders. because our goal was to go, what does a healthy church look like that is connecting effectively with its community, and what does the leadership of that church look like? And so we've ended up 30 plus years on, what was going to be a one-year project actually is still going, and we now have the largest, longest-running survey of church life in the world.
Really?
We do. That's the National Church Life Survey. So what was a project in 1991 was then repeated the next time the census came round and we were looking at the census data again. We went back to the churches and said, well, we did it once, would you like to do it again? And in 1996, 2001, and every 5 years since, and most recently in 2021, we have not only been trying to harness what the census teaches us, but also to listen to churches and continue to listen to the community. So those layers are still there 30 years on with that underlying DNA of it is mission research. It seeks to inform the churches so they can do their cross-cultural work. But given we now have, we are a group of researchers, we have this extraordinary data set, unmatched in the world, we now have international scholars, academics, who now harvest this for us, and we can do, we can answer research questions that, again, no one else can answer because of the nature of what we've collected.
That is so fascinating and so unlikely for Australia, given its kind of secular image, its self-perception, a sort of, you know, disinterest in religion, and there's probably some truth to that in pockets of secular scholarship. And yet it's quite startling to hear that actually there's this Christian organisation that is doing kind of world-class, world-leading research. And so would it be fair to say, and this shocks me even to hear it come out of my mouth, that we have more insight into the nature, scope, extent, characteristics of Christianity in Australia than even a place like America? I can't believe I'm even saying that.
Yes, we do. We do. Wow. They have like 300 denominations. So look, it's easier in Australia to say we do a national study. But they've had to do, they can only do sort of small scope, or they get one person in a congregation to tell you what's going on. They have, you know, denominational studies, etc. But in terms of saying a national study that goes across pretty certainly all the major denominations, is, you know, 20 denominations in Australia pretty well covers it. We don't cover the Orthodox churches, which are very small in number. But to have that breadth, but the unique thing is because it was driven from the churches, we give back every single church their own results. Every local church gets their own results. What that means is we have a study of people who go to church, but we also have a study of congregations, of organisations. So we have thousands of churches where, like a full stakeholder survey, basically, where everybody in the church has reflected on what is happening in that church. You don't need to do that for research. You can just do a sample. But because we've fed back for the sake of those churches, we can study at multiple levels. And that gives us this unique thing that for 30 years we can track organisations, congregations, over time and over what has been an incredibly disrupted time in Australian history, in global Christianity, etc. And one in five Australians go to church, are frequent church attenders, which means if you're going to study, just even if you're not religious, even if you don't care, it is a huge proportion of the Australian population that scholars should be interested in. Should go, what is this group that goes to church at least once a month? You know, that is a significant investment of time and effort. What's going on with that institution, but also those people?
Yeah, because one in five would be about 5 million, right?
Yeah, it's a big number.
It is a big number. It's a significant number, sort of absolutely. Five million people, it's bigger than a lot of sort of smallish countries, possibly bigger than New Zealand even. And one in five, it's not a trivial percentage, and that has all kinds of implications. But Ruth, you mentioned the census a couple of times there, and I'd like to start there because we had a census last year and the results came out, or started to come out, or at least the religion question results came out just this past June, and I think it would be fair to characterise it, this was certainly the media treatment, as a historic census on the religion question, which incredibly has been asked in every census since 1901. It is voluntary, but it has a pretty high return, over 90% this time around. And it was historic because for the first time, those identifying as religious dipped below 50%. Now, I don't think that shocked anyone because we were on a one-way highway to dipping below 50%. The exact number we're talking about was 43.9%, which identified, as Christian. That's right. And that was 52.1% in the previous census in 2016. Yes. And if you go back far enough, it was like almost 100% back in 1901,
I believe.
So, look, I have many specific questions about that, but I want to just start with a bit of an open-ended question. How do we make sense of this number and what's really going on? Because I detect and I know there's a little more going on here, because it's just a simple question that about religious identity. I can't even remember exactly what the question is, actually.
Yes, yeah. Look, Australia, I'll speak about the question first and then sort of what we, some wider reflections on it, what it actually tells us, because I think people overstate what it tells us. Firstly, just the pattern has been, we were incredibly fortunate in Australia. We have a five-yearly census. Many other countries have dropped away from a five-yearly census. The UK is every 10 years, Canada, etc., have gone back to much less regular census. So we have this wonderful five-yearly moment where we learn about the Australian population. And since 1901, as you said, they've asked the question, what is your religion? And that was a standard question. So, and, you know, I've got this lovely chart of every single census and the tracking, and you're quite right. You know, those who identified as Christian in 1901 was pretty well everybody. It toddled along, and there was a moment in 1971, that census, where the government said, it was always an optional question, but the government said, look, if you want to put no religion, you can. They made it an official option. And if you want to mark post-Christendom, if you like, 1971 is a good marker, because the government said you are allowed to identify officially as having no religion when we ask you this, what is your religion question. So then it starts to plummet, because the
Can
no
I
religion...
Just ask, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but...
Yeah.
So because the no religion category wasn't really an option before 1971, does that mean it's quite possible that through that 60s period... If had that question been asked, we would have seen the rise of no religion, because 1971 seems a bit later than what most people would probably think of that age where the disruption you mentioned began.
Someone could have put no religion, but it became a specific option. It became easier to choose no religion, and so then from 1971, the proportion suddenly starts to explode. And it grew until 2011, when it was large enough that the ABS said, oh, this is a big group now, and we're actually going to put it first when we ask the question. Now, when you change the question, any question, survey question, you can change the result. So those of us who just, have been tracking this over decades have gone, don't touch the question, you know. If you want to track change over time, you're mucking it up. They did change it, and no religion went first in 2016, and there was a big leap up. We were curious when it came to 2021. Was that disruption to the question going to mean that the proportion was going to stabilise, and we would have this, bumped up, because it was very easy, first in the list, and there was a campaign, tick no religion and all the rest of it. So you tick that box more easily. Was that going to continue in 2021, or was it going to stabilise? So we really didn't know what was going to happen this time. What we've seen in 2021 is the proportion who say no religion, which is still now first in the list, has gone up again and is now 39% of Australians, from 30% in 2016 to 39% say they have no religion. So that's the pattern of what's happened. And if I speak now to what does it actually mean? Firstly, you're absolutely right. I think it is a historic moment because for the first time since it's been recorded, Australian people who identify as Christian in Australia, it's a minority group.
First time in 120
that's
years,
right.
it's worth.
So noting. It's a minority group, that 44% who say, I'm Christian. We knew it was coming, 52% last time. It's going to go below that 50 mark. You know, somehow that middle is the magic, you know, number. But we knew it was going to go below, and it did. And so that it makes it a historic moment. What does that tell us about Australians and religion? Well, the thing I guess I'd want to highlight here is that when you ask someone, what is your religion, is a bit of a rubbish question, really. It seemed fine in 1901, but it's there. It's about religious affiliation or identification. And we all construct our identity, or our identity is given to us. So I can identify and say, I am female, I am Anglo-Australian, so I'm identifying my ethnic background, my gender, I can say a number of things about myself. I can say, and I construct my identity, and I can tell you about myself by the way I describe myself. So someone's religious identity used to be just a given. It was virtually, in for many people, like an ethnic identity. I'm Anglican or I'm Catholic. I was born Catholic. My parents are Catholic. I belong to that tribe. So it's a statement of belonging and understanding that you are, it's a key part of your identity. When I hear that only 44% of Australians identify as Christian, what I mostly hear, though, is it's not important enough to me to actually identify, to be on the record as belonging to a particular religious group. It's just not salient to me, to my identity, to be bothered marking it. What I want to clarify, though, is that says nothing about what they believe in terms of religious beliefs, whether they practice religious practices, whether they've had religious experiences or have religious knowledge. Because when you measure someone's, this is our sociologists' work, when you measure someone's religiousness, we actually have multiple dimensions. So identification or affiliation is only one measure. It's a good measure, it's a useful measure, but there's all these other dimensions of how a person is religious. And so we go, yep, no surprise, but if you want to understand how religious Australians are, we've got to go beyond that identification, but yet it's not important to Australians as much as it used to be.
Yeah, and that's really the seminal change, isn't it?
Yes.
The affiliation, connection, sense of belonging to effectively a denomination, you know, an organised form of Christianity.
Yeah.
And we'll in due course get into this question of religiousness and spirituality, because your own work at NCLS reveal some interesting things that you wouldn't necessarily predict from just reading the census results.
Yes.
But before we get there, I would like to just drill down a bit, because there's some interesting discrete parts of the census return, as far as I'm aware. Although, actually, maybe some of this was pulled from your own research, and you can clarify that, because it's probably all mixed up in my notes. But, you know, part of this story, of course, is that while there is this decline in Christian affiliation, denominational affiliation that begins in 1971 formally based on the census, there is a significant growth in other religions, but from a very low base.
Yes.
And for example, Hinduism exploded up 55.3%, but it's only 2.7% of the population. But this is a religion that probably, I'm guessing, didn't exist except maybe in some quaint traveller or migrant back in the 1900s, and this is a consequence of very significant migration from the subcontinent in the last kind of decade or two. So whilst part of this story is an overall decline in religion, if we move out of Christianity, and Islam's also growing and is now, I think, 3.2%, I'm guessing Buddhism might be growing too. So what's the story there? I mean, it's still overall, I think, a relatively small percentage, but it's not just purely a story of decline in religion, is it?
Look, I think there's a few layers there. When we talk about the decline in Christianity, what you see is that it's the Catholics and the Anglicans. Of that 8 percentage point drop from the 52 to 44%, 6 percentage points are Catholics and Anglicans. So the other denominations are worth, they're very small, but they're worth looking at and going, it's perhaps a different story. The Baptists, I understand, have been quite stable. So it's that I'm Catholic, I'm Anglican, I'm born that way, and people are going, I don't even think like that anymore. That's, you sort of have to bring it back to those two big groups is where the damage, if you like, has happened.
Really what you're alluding to, I think, is that there's a particularity with Anglicanism and Catholicism where it could be a kind of cultural, personal attachment in a way that if you sort of go back historically, to be a Presbyterian or a Baptist, any of the dissenting really involves some kind of choice and often a cost.
Yes.
And so possibly had more conviction attached. Yep. I mean, there's obviously great conviction in a lot of Catholics and Anglicans, but it's more of a mixed bag, I guess you could say. And so when, if you look at the settlement history of Australia, it was very common for someone to identify as a Catholic or Anglican. Yes. Didn't necessarily mean they sort of practiced as a Christian, but throughout that settlement history, Baptists and I'm guessing Presbyterians and maybe some Congregationalists were, I'm guessing, more likely to be consistently kind of that identity meant something in terms of the practice.
You're absolutely right, because that affiliation, that identification went along with choices about beliefs and practices. Small but much more consistent. Some erosion but much more consistent, So when we talk about a decline in religion, we go, well, actually it's a decline in Christianity, not in other religions, as you've already pointed out. Other religions went up from 8% to 10%, just a little bit of growth overall, but it's gone up. When you look at decline in Christianity, you go, well, it's actually the Catholics and Anglicans who've declined, at the big declines. They're, you know, bits and pieces elsewhere, but they're the big movers. So that's where drilling down is really helpful. When you come to those other religions, which have gone from 8% to 10% of all Australians who identify as religious, what we know is, migration is key. Migrants are more likely to be religious than Anglo non-migrant Australians. And where they come from forms their, is a big source. So you've mentioned, Hinduism. You've got to be careful. It's, lies, damned lies and statistics, So when you read the papers, and I've seen the headlines, last time I remember it was Hinduism has doubled, and you go, that was from 1% to 2% overall. And now we go, we're up to 3%, 55% growth. And people go, oh my goodness, and people going, what's happened? Everybody's Hindu now. And go, no, we're still under 3% of all Australians identify as Hindu. And guess what? It aligns with the very strong Indian migration patterns that have come into Australia. And so you can watch those patterns and it goes together. So I think that's... And the Catholics, who are incredibly multicultural and migrants come from all around the world, they have actually managed to sustain their affiliation helped by migration patterns, because migrants have come and said, I'm Catholic, from whatever country, Vietnam or Philippines or wherever, have actually identified as Catholic. So
actually, I wanted to mention that, talking about drilling down, because this was a really fascinating statistic, because the decline in Anglicanism has really been quite catastrophic next to the Catholic decline, which has declined, but not nearly as catastrophically. Yes. And I'm guessing that is, I don't want to say purely migration, but there isn't and hasn't really been migration from Anglican countries other than the United Kingdom, where I'm guessing the Anglican affiliation is in some kind of death spiral as well, whereas we're getting Filipinos and Vietnamese, Latin Americans. We had the big migration from Italy and other Catholic countries in Europe.
There the post-war migration was,
plenty of Catholics in India as well. Not all the Indian migrants coming to Australia are Hindus. So the other thing is that I was actually somewhat surprised to learn that, not surprised about this part, but the Catholic Church is the largest Christian denomination, I think, at 20%, with the Anglicans second at only 9.8%.
Yep.
So I think there are overall significantly more Protestants, but they're kind of split between lots of different groups. But it was only in 1981 that the... It was only... Well, I think 1981 was the last census where Anglicans outnumbered Catholics, and it was pretty close, with 26.1% identifying as Anglican and 26% as Catholic. And so since then, Anglicanism's really fallen off a cliff like no other denomination.
That's right.
I think some people, I vaguely have recollections of people saying, oh, you know, the Uniting Church has declined a lot, but it was only a small percentage even after its creation in the 70s, from what I've seen in the stats. And it has declined, but nowhere near like that 26% down to under 10%.
That's right.
For Anglicans.
Yes, the Anglicans have their own story in Australia. I mean, if you wind back 200 years, it was as close to the established religion as you could have. You know, the Catholics have the priestless years as part of their history, and, you know, the old narrative of the Catholic Irish convicts versus the Anglican establishment. You know, there's an interesting story there. But as you say, the Anglicans have their own pathway in Australian history now with regard to religion, and very, very challenging, because it's, primarily UK. Migrants from UK are much, you know, they're still a very large group, but it's not a constant inflow, whereas the Catholics have certainly benefited from all those migration flows that you described. Yeah.
In some ways, I wonder if this is the missed story in the or the unrecognised story in the sort of secular coverage, that, like you say, the Anglican Church starts as a sort of informal established church right back at settlement, and it's kind of dominant numerically and culturally even for a long period of time. And it's the whole Catholic grievance in Australia and history of sectarianism, which is really a sort of a one-way sectarianism, I think it would be fair to say, of Anglican establishment figures being suspicious of Catholics and the like. The whole ethnic question is wrapped up in there with the Irish, of course, before we get post-World War II migration. But the Anglican Church at 9.8%, and that's not the percentage of churchgoers.
No.
So it would, if it's, what, 1 in 5, then maybe 2-3% of those that identify as Anglican might be going to an Anglican church. But the point I'm really heading towards is the Anglican Church, which is this, along with the Catholics, I guess, this dominant part of the Australian story, now can't really claim to be any more significant than just a lot of other small Protestant minority churches in Australia.
It's challenging. And we have added to that difficult narrative for the Anglicans by measuring how many people do go to church and looking at the gap. And one of the things we've found is, the difference between affiliation and attendance. So attendance is that public practice of religion where I actually, you know, a church, a religious service attendance is the most obvious way that you can do a public practice of religion. There's other ways, but that's a very obvious and measurable way. So as we've shown the gap, for Anglicans, you know, you have an affiliation at one level and they've got the greatest gap of any denomination between their attendance and their affiliation.
People who
say they're Anglican and go to Anglican churches. For a period there, if you said you were Pentecostal on the census, there were more people who went to Pentecostal churches than identified as Pentecostal.
Oh, really?
Right? So it was such a different story. The Catholics are somewhere in between. But what we've also added to the story when you talk about attendance is that it used to be, when we first started counting in 1991, our first moment with the National Church Life Survey, of the top five denominations. So this is, again, think attendance. We're out of census at the moment. We're into head counting people who go to church. The order was Catholic number one with about 50%. So it was 50% Catholic, 50% Protestant who actually went to church. And the order was Catholic, Anglican, Uniting, Baptist, ACC, which is Australian Christian Churches, which was Assemblies of God. So not even counting all the Pentecostals, but just counting that one movement, That was the top five. So roll forward 25 years to 2016. This is the next time the next set of figures I've got. So it was Catholic, Anglican, Uniting, Baptist, ACC. It became Catholic, ACC second. A Pentecostal denomination is the second largest denomination in the country of people who attend church. Anglican slipped to third. Baptist still at fourth, Uniting down to fifth.
That is a massive story too.
Yes, it is.
I have not heard or seen that anywhere.
No.
And that's interesting because I picked out a stat on the Pentecostals and I was going to ask you about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just completely thrown what I thought that stat may have meant, because on the 2016 census, I think it was, or maybe this is your own research, forgive me if I'm mixing up the two, only 1.1% of people either identified or were recorded as Pentecostal,
yes,
which surprised me. I would have guessed it was 5% or above.
Yes.
It has grown and it's been on a growth trajectory, but it was like under 1% if we go back a bit. But the thing, and of course, you've just sort of shown that the church attendance does not correlate with obviously the identity, and so that I'm guessing the story there is that 1.1% probably correlates pretty closely to the number of people in church, whereas obviously the 9.8% of Anglicans must be down about 1% or just under 1%, which is quite depressing. But the thing that surprised me about that overall figure, I'm just going to throw all the figures out there and then you can unpack them for us, is that that puts the Pentecostals, at least on paper, as a smaller denomination than some of the older, let's call them, non-conformist Protestant churches. So we've got Presbyterians at 2.8%.
Yep.
We've got Lutheran at 1.2%, slightly bigger than the Pentecostals. And the one that really surprised me, although I guess there's a migration story here, is that 2.6% were Eastern Orthodox, but I'm guessing 2.6% are not in church, because that's probably more akin to the Catholic Anglican story of yesteryear, where, you know, if you're Greek or Russian and you're asked on a survey, there's a strong, your sort of Eastern Orthodox faith or your Greek, Romanian, Bulgarian church is a big part of your identity still.
Yes, it's part of your ethnic and cultural identity. Religion is totally intertwined there. Yeah, there's a few sub-stories here if you like. Okay.
I'd love to hear them.
So let's pick off the Lutherans first. The poor old Lutherans, in the question that is on the census form, if you get above a certain percentage, you get to be on the list.
Oh, right.
And ABS puts them in order, going, that's how no religion ended up arriving on the list, and then going, oh, crumbs, we better, it went up the list and it got to the top and went, we really have to put this top. Because Catholics on their own are smaller than no religion. So no religion became the biggest group. Well, it's got to go first. Catholics was the next biggest, got to go second. Well, the Lutherans went under the line. So in 2016, there weren't enough Lutherans to list. So they got walloped in 2016 because if you were Lutheran, you had to write in, I'm Lutheran, I'm other, and I write in Lutheran. So you see them popping along and then they plummet down and they've gone down again this time, because you've got to be so Lutheran and care enough so much that you'll actually go to the bother of writing I'm Lutheran in. So that's their story. Presbyterians still have, I think, a residual of ethnic cultural identity. I must be Presbyterian. There it is on the list. So they've maintained that. And there's also been a real in churches, there have been sort of people who really strongly now embrace a Presbyterian identity as well. So they've strengthened that a bit. So that's partly probably why they're hanging on there. The poor Pentecostals have got another set of problems. and they've been trying to advocate with the ABS, and not that successfully over the last years. And this is again about the changing shape where the institution or society is taking a while to catch up with the reality. So it's like we haven't quite caught up with the fact that Anglicans are not the established church in dominance anymore, and let's not even go to what they're doing now, because in terms of who gets counted where, but that is an incredibly changing story for the Anglicans. For the Pentecostals, they have experienced incredible growth over the 30 years we've been tracking them. I'll throw in another thing and we might come back to this, but in terms of church attendance has gone down, but when you unpack that, it's the Catholics who've gone down, Anglicans who've gone down, mainstreams have gone down, but the Protestants together have experienced net growth. So overall, there's a decline, Protestants net growth, and the reason is that the Pentecostal growth has countered the mainline decline. So Pentecostals who go to church have gone massively grown. Problem is, when you get to the census and talk to the government, they're not one big clean institution with a nice clean name. There is no Pentecostal denomination. There are multiple movements, networks, independent Pentecostal churches, and they have to try and present as a single unified group, and they had to argue, please put Pentecostal on the form for us. But what the census team has to do, the ABS team, lots of people write down the name of their church. They don't even know their church is Pentecostal, or they know their church is, Acts Global or International Network of Churches. These are Pentecostal names of churches, ACC, C3, INC. There's all these names. They write that down. The Pentecostal leaders are not convinced that the ABS people even know how to recognise those names. The people in the churches don't necessarily even know that their church is a Pentecostal church. They just go to their local Alive church or, whatever it is. And you end up with that they've been trying to campaign, and they actually had their own campaign trying to get people to go, please write Pentecostal on the form. So they think they're being undercounted on the census form because of this fragmented approach that Pentecostal movements are by nature. And yet they're going, look, we've been told we're the second, one of our movements, our biggest movement, the ACC, is the second largest in the country.
Oh, so that's just the ACC.
That's just the ACC on its own, let alone put the rest of the Pentecostals in together. Yeah.
That's a fascinating... Yeah. Subplot, really, isn't it?
Yes.
And again, one that warns you to be a little circumspect when it comes to the media reporting about the census figure, because, yes, there's all the story of decline that we've been speaking about, but that's fascinating to learn that in this same period, Protestant church attendance, I think it was, I've got this right, has actually gone up.
Net growth,
and that's all down to Pentecostals.
Pentecostals and I'll call them the large evangelical Protestants, Baptist Church of Christ, Salvation Army, holding their own or experiencing some growth as well.
Yep.
But not like the Pentecostals.
Which does... This brings me to my final sort of question on this point before we move on to the more complex story of religion and spirituality, which, as I think I've already alluded to, or you've probably alluded to, doesn't correlate perfectly with this story of church attendance and affiliation. And that is, thinking about the future, because this says to me that there is a story of decline, and I want to ask something specifically about that in a moment, but it's also a story of very significant changes in the nature and characteristics of Christianity.
Yeah.
And the fact that there is still some life in pockets of the church, again, makes me a little cautious about predicting or assuming that this trend of decline will just inexorably lead down to nothing. And so the question, I know it's hard to predict that, but I do want to ask a question that you're probably going to hate as as an empirical social scientist. But... common sense tells me there has to be a bottom here with the decline. It seems inconceivable it's going to go to zero, and there's reason to think that's almost implausible, because there are pockets of resistance, staying power and growth in Christian churches. There's migration's not about to end anytime soon. Could it I mean, my assumption would be we'll see another decline in the next census, maybe the next one. But it's got to bottom out at some point, because there's this sort of one-fifth of Australians that regularly attend a religious service, which I'm guessing can include a mosque or a synagogue.
It can, but that would be a very small group.
Of course.
But yes, it can.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So are you in a position to speculate at all or even just perhaps give us some things to consider in terms of this longer-term trend?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think you're... Yes, it's not a comfortable question to answer. But I think you're right that migration will continue, presumably, unless Australia gets totally, you know, locked away. But migration will continue. And unless something dramatic changes, we certainly know in the global south that Christianity and religion continue to grow and grow dramatically. So... if we have migrants coming from the global south, we will continue to see religious migrants probably forming religious communities in Australia. So that will be one source. I think you're right. I'm expecting to see further decline overall, though, because I think we will continue to lose those whose tribal... I won't even use that word. It's that ethnic cultural identity part, that religion being tied up with that, is going to continue to erode, and just the salience of it is not going to be there for, you know, another group. As the oldest Australians die, the youngest ones are not, it's not embedded in their identity. So I think we'll see decline there. So will it bottom out? Well, as you say, if we know that around one in five Australians attend religious services, that is, it's a level of commitment to religion that I would expect would also align with identity, so that I go to church, you know, quite regularly, and so when the census time comes around. So maybe that bottom, if we're going to have a guess, we might guess that the bottom of the, you know, the bottom line would be around that 20%, assuming that attendance stays around there, or that it would match with at least whatever the attendance levels were. Because identity will be aligned with those other significant religious practices.
Yeah. And that makes me mindful, and this is a good way of going into the religiousness, spirituality as two concepts, that you can't assume that those ticking no religion are somehow militant atheists. And some of your research shows the story is a lot more complex than that, and that, for example, people might engage in spiritual practices, but I'm guessing tick no religion, because in their minds they're like, well, I don't go to a Catholic church or an Anglican church, but I pray and I believe in some kind of deity or spiritual force, and I meditate, and for me that's kind of almost a religious type thing. So take us into how do we enter into this part of the fascinating story?
Yes. So we've had a good conversation about affiliation, identification as one really useful way to understand how a person is religious. As I mentioned earlier, we have these different dimensions, though, of religiousness. So we ask about, what are your religious beliefs? Do you believe in God? Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus? Or, you know, it can be any religious beliefs whatsoever, Muhammad, whoever. Then we ask about mystical, supernatural or mystical experiences. And again, we frame it in a way, this is a question that's asked across the world in international studies, and we all try and ask it the same so that we can have comparisons. But this, you know, have you had a mystical or supernatural experience of which you have no doubt, either good or bad? So it could be someone going, I saw the ghost of my auntie, you know, I am positive. So it's not necessarily a Christian mystical experience, but it's trying to embrace the full religious experience dimension to go, whatever form of mysticism or something other, something transcendent that has broken through in your life, have you experienced that? You know, may have been once, may have been regularly, doesn't matter. So, but that's a religiousness. Then there's religious knowledge, which is just, do you know who Moses was? Can you name the four Gospels? Can you name the, you know, holy scriptures of blah, whatever it is? So that's religious knowledge. Then there's private religious practice. So that would be things like praying or meditating, things you might do in your own home, might be a shrine in your own home or something like that. But private practices, and then public practices, which, as I mentioned, is things like attendance at religious services is public practices. So when we do our work, we go, how do you identify yourself? And then what about all these other things? So one of the fun things that we've done a study on with identity, if we just stay with identity first, there's a we go, okay, it's not what is your religion as the government asks, but we say, well, how do you identify yourself? How would you describe yourself? And there's this whole conversation around in amongst sociologists about, oh, it's called SBNR, which stands for spiritual but not religious. They've thrown away the institution, they don't associate, but they're still spiritual. And that has a lot of resonance for people. Oh, it's spiritual but not religious. So what we did in our Australian community surveys, which is of all Australian population, like a panel, and we asked them, we give them one question. We go from 0 to 10, do you see yourself as a religious person? So how do you describe yourself? Forget what everybody else says, forget the labels that everybody else has. Do you see yourself as a religious person? 0 to 10, stand on the line somewhere. And then we ask, do you see yourself as a spiritual person? So is this a different thing? Do you identify differently? So stand on the line, 0 to 10. Then we put those two together and we do a fancy thing called cluster analysis, and we go, how do Australians cluster when you put those two dimensions together? And so if you imagine an axis, you might have low spiritual to high spiritual, 1 to 10, and then along the other axis, low religion to high religion. So where do they cluster? And if I can describe the outcome, which we have run on 3 different sets of data over the years, keeps coming out basically the same. There are 4 clusters of Australians. First, there's the group, and I'll give you the numbers for our 2021 Australian Community Survey, done November 2021. So we'll do it again in 2022, but this is the latest figures that we have. So who says low spiritual, low religion? I'm not religious, I'm not spiritual. That group. And that's your classic, you know, the people who are fully disconnected. 37% of Australians fall into that cluster. So they are the neither religious or spiritual, 37%. And when you look at them more closely, what we learn about them is they don't believe, they don't practice, they've had no religious experience, but perhaps most significantly, they have no relationships with people who are religious. Mm. Their family is not religious. So there's your...
So they kind of live within non-religious communities or networks.
Yes, that's right. So you're sitting at about 37% of Australians in that space where they are fully disconnected, if you like, from any religious engagement. And your atheists will be in there, you know. Not 37% are atheists, but just 37% go, I'm neither spiritual or religious, I don't identify.
Could you extrapolate from that, I know this is probably a bit fraught, but that, or maybe just get an indicative sense that the rate of atheism, like genuine atheism, must be something lower than that 37% then?
It is. The closest I can give you is we ask a question, do you believe in God or a higher power, right? And we have 24% of Australians say, I believe in a personal God. Sorry, personal God. A quarter of Australians believe in a personal God. Another 31% say, I believe in some kind of higher power, some other. So you've got over 50% of Australians, look, I believe in that there is a transcendent other. 1 in 5 say they don't know. We call those agnostics. Okay.
The definition of
agnostic. Yeah. And a quarter say, I don't believe there is a God. So that's 24% who I would, in simple terms, I go 24% atheist, 20% agnostic, 50% believe something exists. A God or a higher power exists.
And which, if we bring that 24% in relation to the census figure, which I think had, what was the percentage?
The no religion percentage? Yeah, which is like 44% or something.
Okay, so
yeah.
It just shows that that only perhaps a little over half of those might be characterised as properly characterised as atheists.
Oh, people who identify as no religion pray, attend church, believe. Absolutely. Yeah. It is an identity. That's why it's really important to understand it as is it part of your embedded identity? No, not so much. Doesn't mean you're not practicing other things. So yeah, that's where we're sitting on
that. And is that understood at all in the for want of a better term, the secular realm of Australia?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a simplistic understanding, and certainly the strong atheistic campaign who really don't even want to ask the question and don't want anything religious to have any influence will quickly jump to that assumption. But there's no basis in the data, in the empirical evidence, that people who say they have no religion are atheist. It's just not, it doesn't go together.
Especially if they could be a church attendee.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great.
Yeah. And there are. There are committed people who are highly committed who said, I don't want to buy into this religion stuff, but I am, you know, they'd be among the most committed people. Now, it's a very small group, but they will also pick no religion sometimes, a few of them. Yeah.
Because the problem is religion has negative connotations, even for some Christians. You know, there's this whole Bonhoeffer thing of religionless Christianity that's quite sexy these days.
Yep.
And I'm guessing, and I want to ask, and I know I've derailed you, but we'll get back on track with the whole spiritual picture, but I would have thought that spirituality has far more positive connotations than religion. And so I could see why people in a survey might say, oh, yeah, I'm a spiritual person. Because even in sort of non-religious circles, it's to say I'm spiritual, when someone's described as very spiritual, it's like, you know, they're very sensitive and they're kind of philosophical and deep, and it has all these positive connotations, I'm guessing, as well for young people.
Yes, you'd think so, and that's certainly what we hear and understand as well. But here's a couple more surprises then. So when we did ask, the first thing is when people said that to me with the census, and they go, I'm just not going to tick like anything. I'm going to just tick, and I'm going, please just tick Christian, like tick it, you know, tick something, because otherwise you're lost, you know, in terms of someone who is deeply committed person of faith, you're not counted, you know, you've lost your count. Anyway, but when we come back to the Australian Community Survey, where we have this 37% who are neither religious or spiritual, how you describe yourself, let's come to that SBNR group. That's the one they go, oh, that must be growing. Everybody, that's nice, it's soft, and everybody, you know, likes that. It's not offensive to anybody to say you're spiritual. You're maybe a bit flaky, but, you know, I'm not offended by you, you know. What we actually discovered is that only 13% of Australians say I'm high spiritual, low religion.
Oh, that's interesting.
It blows apart so many other things. Now, it's the way we did it. Obviously, our methodology got to that result. And if you ask them, are you spiritual but not religious, they might go, oh, yes. More people might have ticked that. But when we ask that, where do you stand on the line, there's a group of people who are older, female, more into alternative spiritualities, who really form that identity of I'm spiritual but not religious.
Are these aging hippies?
Yeah, Mark, I didn't say it. You know, but there's the stereotype.
That's an unscientific.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they probably all live in Byron Bay and Nimbin.
Indeed. You said it, not me.
That's right.
But it really was a very small number, and I've done it 3 times, and we keep getting this very small identify as low religion. What we find then, that leaves, if you're adding up, that leaves about half of Australians. What we find is about 26% of Australians are up the high end. I see myself as a religious person, right up near the 10s, 8, 9, 10s. I see myself as a spiritual person. So they are right up in the top corner in those two axes, and they are, you're highly engaged. So a quarter of Australians are highly engaged. They believe, they belong, they practice, they know people, their family is religious. It's a whole package. The big surprise for the churches particularly, because they always think about the atheists or the people who are very disengaged and anti-religion. The big surprise is that we keep pointing out is That leaves you with a quarter of Australians who sit in the middle as moderately religious and moderately spiritual. So they have not fully abandoned a religious identity. Do you see yourself as a spiritual person? Yes, I sit at, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know? And do you see yourself as a religious person? Same. They sit around that 5, 6, 7 in that point, which gives this, and when you look at them, they go, they may go, oh yeah, I believe in a higher power, or I believe in a personal God. I pray, I go to church sometimes, and I used to go, and my family, I have people I know who attend, so they have relationship. What we find also about that group, so we say to people, if you're wanting to connect, well, you can fight with the hardline atheists, do your apologetics if you like. I don't know where it'll get you because it's going to be a tough ask. Your SBNR spirituals, okay, know who they are. But what about this group who are warm, who have soft edges, who know people, and they're going, oh, I'm not really practicing. But they are there with relationship, with some level of belief and connection. It's like, why don't you try actually re-engaging a quarter of Australians who are currently in that space? Because that would double the size of the church.
Wow, there you go. That's very interesting. Mm. I suppose the response might be, where do we find these people? You know, how do we sift yes. between the atheist that is likely to yes. be more likely to be hostile or unreceptive,
yeah.
and the person who already might have a more open mind towards it, but might have some obstacles or have fallen away or be hesitant to get yeah. too involved for whatever reason. That gives you things to work with, because yes. most Australians live in these big cities and they're all intermingled. I'm guessing it's not like there's the atheist suburb or the atheist yeah. town and the sort yes. of more agnostic or sort of open but not committed
yes.
crowd. So is that potentially one of the obstacles? Or I guess you just have to go out and evangelize and as the Bible says, you know, some seeds will just not take root, others will take root yeah. and then be yeah. strangled.
I'll give you two responses to that. One is understand your context. So there are suburbs that are highly atheistic.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
are they the wealthy inner city ones?
Or? Yes. Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be tougher there. You know, it's going to be tougher. So that's different context. There are Bible belts.
Yeah.
And in Sydney, we're in Sydney. When I know Sydney, and in Sydney, the northern part of Sydney, for those who know Sydney, used to be the Bible belt. Well, the belt has slipped below the harbour now and is in the southwest.
Oh, that's interesting.
So why? Because that's where we're most multicultural and where most of our migrant communities are. And as we've said, they're more religious. So you want to find religion in Sydney, you will find it in the south-southwest. Very high levels of religion. So that's, again, who's on the north? The Anglican Anglos, just to be stereotypical, you know?
That's where the declining Anglicans are. Probably.
That's where they are. And if you want to find religious communities that are stronger, more committed, you know. So that's a little case study of one city in that mix there.
I think Canberra's one of the most godless cities, isn't it?
It certainly, yes, I'm not surprised. It used to be, so I think Canberra's yeah. probably the same. So there are, your context, it's harder in some places than others. That's response number one. Second response is, what do you do if you want to find those moderately religious, moderately spiritual, you know, that they're holding the two together? It's all about relationship, 100% relationship, because no matter what we ask, whether we ask newcomers to church life or we ask Australians in the community about their response, here's an example. We said in our community survey to Australians, would you go to church? So we took it to Christian churches at this point, not just religion, but would you go to a Christian church, not weddings, funerals, but an ordinary Christian worship service if invited by a friend or a family member? And 3 in 10 say, yes, I would. And another 16% said, I'm not sure, maybe. That to me, I go, that's half Australians going, if you invited me, I would come. Then we did a follow-up question and we said, okay, what would make it easier for you to accept? You know, what would block you? Yes, classic things. It's the scandals, it's the, you know, inappropriateness, it's the what the institutional church has done. They are those blockers and they are there. They go, I'm not interested. What would help you accept that invitation? And we gave them a whole list of things which include if it was important to my friend or family member that I come, if it's convenient, if it's timely, meaning short, if it was hospitable, if I felt like I'd be made welcome. We had a whole list of things like that to go through. If they were doing good work in the community, so there was a good reputation of social justice work or advocacy or something like that. Whole list of reasons. By far and away, the most important thing that Australians say is, if it was important to my friend or family member that I come and they asked me to come, I would go. So if you were asking me, how do I find these people? I go, talk to your cousin.
Yeah.
Talk to your brother.
Yep.
Mums, talk to your kids, because mothers are consistently cited as the most important person who has influenced me in my faith. Mother, long way above father, grandparents, etc. So mums, ask them to come. They'll do it for you.
Yeah.
They may not care, but if you want them to engage, then invite them and they'll come for you.
I want to stay with that just a second. Yeah. That's really interesting, because I do know that sort of historically, I think the church really found very fertile ground with women in the ancient world more than men. And I could be wrong, but it seems consistently, or if not consistently, perhaps in different ways. But like right now, I think the average person, I had a friend on the podcast who's a Catholic theologian, and I think according to research in the Catholic Church, you know, the average person in a pew is a Filipino woman.
Yep.
And which gets both the ethnic diversity, but
yep.
But there's a, you know, there are more. This is one of the great, again, surprises of the actual empirical research versus a disjuncture with the public narrative. So you've got the Catholic Church, let's face it, it's the pinup boy, pun intended, for a sexist, abusive church. And yet most of the people that attend are female. And so clearly there's an appeal there. So what, perhaps, I don't know, maybe this goes into your psychology of religion expertise. Is it as simple as the mothers are more important because if there's a religious person in the household, it's most likely to be the mother, not the father, in a household where one's religious but not the other? Or is it deeper than that? Is there, I don't know, if you hear it from your mother, does it have a different impact? Or is it just too many fathers not engaged in their kids anyway?
I think you've probably named the issues. Yes. Your intuition is right. Women are more religious than men. That has been true for as long as anybody's studied it.
Is that a global phenomenon across all religions? It is a global
phenomenon across all religions. Women are more religious than men.
Wow, that's so interesting. So the fact that
Christian Australian women in every denomination are more religious than men is not surprising to me, because that's what we would expect to see. And if you think about who, I'm going to tread carefully here, but who is running churches, you will find the volunteers are going to be women. So who's actually doing the most of the tasks in many churches, it'll be women. Now, what are the social dynamics going on there? There's a few things. One is certainly during the 50s, etc., when women were more homemakers, women were more likely then to be volunteers, able to contribute to volunteer organisations such as churches. So you've got, there was a capacity there. I think that's one reality. And I know there's been studies of working women. Are working women less religious? Because are they now, one of the theories is women were getting their, some status, if you like, by being able to contribute, or they were getting some social power by being able to contribute in that domain, whereas women who were then professional and working their identity was more embedded in their work self, and they didn't need to invest in this alternate social space, if you like. So that's been a set of studies that I'm going to do some work on fairly soon again to go, well, I found some evidence, 2022, what's it like now? You know, is that theory still workable? I think there is stuff about the nurturing role of women in households that continues, and that probably would have an influence, why a mother would have an influence. The engagement, as you said, that women are more engaged than men in their children and also in the church, so you get that circular thing happening there as well. I think there's an interesting conversation, again, this is, you know, there's a lot of dangerous territory can circle around here. Here's another one, but it's there's been some conversation around the feminization of religion, and that it's in your psychological types, like your personality types, that if you are more likely to be, I'll use the Myers-Briggs language, you know, but a feeling person rather than a thinking person, you're more likely to, like, people who are in churches are certainly leaders, priests, pastors, ministers, much more likely to be F than T. Mm-hmm. So there's a more feminine presence, if you like, because of that, if you go to that simple sort of emotional intelligence, or, you know, a good pastor is going to be someone who's actually a good listener, has good empathy, is caring about the person, and they can sound like female traits. You know, you can see why I'm really
skating
around all of this, but there's something in there about why religion, you know, works. Now, here's the challenge. Like, there's two challenges. Why are all the leaders then men when you have this largely female, you know, locally and also globally, largely female involvement? But there's also the other side to go, what is it that we do that disengages boys quite young, and what are we doing wrong? Because it shouldn't be like that.
Yeah.
You know, boys, young men, and then, you know, older men should actually be able to find places in, I'm going to say, local churches where they, again, are able to explore and express religion in ways. So it comes down to how you do children's ministry in churches, again, making it a Christian conversation here for a moment. But it's like, are we getting it wrong when we just get them to do craft activities, or do you know what I mean? Like, it gets very concrete of what are we missing here in terms of a breadth of ways to engage boys and girls in ways that help them stay connected, because boys drop out first.
Yeah,
and it's not just later, but what we've seen
drop
in our
out
studies,
young, do they?
They drop out younger. Like, you can see that gap really young. Yeah.
That is so
fascinating.
Mm. And I'd love to hear more about that sometime. But speaking of children, how about we finish with Gen Z?
who do you mean by Gen Z?
Well, Gen Z, what is that? That's, I've got to try and think of the dates. I wrote something on generational change not too long ago. The problem is the year ranges kind of vary around the edges, but I thought Gen Z...
you're talking sort of young adults.
You're
the
sociologist.
Yeah,
Help me out here.
I can tell you how other people define it. But do you mean like we're talking young adults at the moment, that kind of group?
Yeah, maybe I've got the wrong generation, but I know that you have some very interesting findings with young people that seems to completely buck all of the trends
we've been discussing.
So although I may have set us off in a misleading path with the terminology, I might just hand over to you to clean it up and just, you know what I'm trying to bring into the conversation, so take it away, Ruth.
No, look, the labels are helpful shorthand, and my own PhD work was on age differences in churches, so you can understand, just very quickly, you can understand a person's age when you think about how old they are in terms of the period of history we're in. We're being influenced by the fact that we are in the middle of a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. So if you're a young person now, you are being shaped by the fact that your university life or your high school life, etc., is being spent in a bedroom. Mm-hmm. You know, like the history is shaping that young person. You are also, you can understand someone by their stage of life. So you're at a stage of life where you're having small children, or you are having, you know, you're an empty nester, or you're retired. Like, that's your stage of life. Generational theory is around the idea that what was happening to you at a particular time in history when you were a young adult, what was happening at that time shapes you and your values and your practices in a way that you then carry with you. So a label like, you know, the baby boomers, they were born during, they were a boom, demographic boom in births post-war, and they grew up in a time of incredible wealth and, you know, abundance.
Opportunity.
And opportunity, and that has shaped them all the way through. So we're now looking at this.
Can I just, sorry, I've got to interrupt, Ruth, because this is so fascinating. So you mentioned there the theory of generational differences. Is that a, is there a consensus that that's a solid theory, or is it, is it controversial? What's your own view on?
Oh no, I think that it's borne out by the data. Again, I'm going back to my own PhD and going, I found the evidence for a cohort where you have an age cohort that you can track, and you go, crumbs, this stuff that they were doing when they were young, or thinking when they were young, you know, there's a bit of change. Like, you face your own mortality and you might change how you think about God or something. But overall, you do. You carry what you've been formed with, you carry through. So what happened in church life was a stage of life effect, where it used to be, before the 60s and 70s, people would say, the kids would leave. They would break from their mother and father, you know, and they would go, I don't do it your way. They would then go and they would have babies, and then they'd go, oh, I need a good stable, you know, structure for my children to grow up in. And so they would then come back to church. So every generation, that's how it went. In the 60s and 70s, when the young people left the church, the older ones went, doesn't matter, they'll be back. And it was the first generation that didn't come back with their own children.
Wow.
That's what happened in the 60s and 70s to the church. So groups like the Uniting Church and Anglicans and everybody else went, they'll be back. Uh-oh, they didn't come back. And suddenly you're missing generation after generation.
Hence the decline.
That's right.
So is the decline we sort of began the conversation with, is it also a generational story? That it, that there's one generation that really blew a hole in the church?
Baby boom blew a hole in it. And then the next Gen X, down Gen Y, Gen Z, then it became sexy and everybody started giving labels. Gen X was the first one because they went, oh, what do we do after the baby boom? You know, so then these, but they're really tracking cohorts. Now, where I think it's an overstretch is going, here's a five-year group. That's an age cohort. We're going to give a label, and they're totally unique because, you know, whatever, and going, well, yes and no, really. There's not that much difference between that birth year and the next birth year. I think it is, we've had so much change, though, where you go, what have been the formative experiences? And if it's dramatically different, like your cohort has only experienced having screens in your hands, you know, or something, that's very different from a cohort who learnt it when they were adults. So there are certainly cohorts who've been shaped. So let's come to our...
It's very interesting stuff.
Yeah, it really is. But it's like it's useful, and then it's gone into good marketing or some catchphrase that is over-invested with meaning. But yes, it's certainly a useful set of handles. So in our Australian community survey, when we were looking at the spirituality and religiousness of Australians, I simply divided it up into four age groups. Didn't give them labels, but let's call that age group... and we could have, I could have carved it, but just to make it simple, four age groups. The over 70s was one group, 50 to 69, 30 to 49, and then 18 to 30, maybe 35. Anyway, it was four even-sized age groups to try and just go, let's see if there's age, what's going on with age. What you're referring to that came out as quite a surprise was... is a couple of layers, but here's the simple way of describing it. What we saw when we tried to track age, and we had these four groups, and we went, how many of the young ones believe or whatever it is? And then you try, you're thinking, is there a relationship where it'll go up and up and up with age? You know, the older you are, the more likely you are to pray,
Which would be the conventional wisdom,
that's right, that's right. More likely you are to attend church, more likely you are to whatever. What we discovered, not on everything, but on quite a few things of those measures of religiousness, was a U shape, which meant the oldest were had more likely to, and the youngest age group, the 18 to 35s, that young adult group, were also more likely. And the group in the middle, particularly the 50 to 69s, who are the Gen Xers, were the least likely. And what we started to see, which has really challenged a lot of people's thinking with this U-shape, is sort of two things. One is those young adults are more open than we realised. Mm. And you got to be careful, because the census is correct. They don't say they are religious. They are really unlikely to say they've got a religious identity. It's not important to them. But they tell us 30% are going to church at least once a month. That blew our mind.
30% of 18 to 30, 35.
Tell us they're going to church. Now, people are finding that hard to believe, because they're going, I'm not seeing them. But we're going, well,
they're probably not at the right churches.
Number one, they're not at the right churches. And then the other thing we learned from them when we asked is, how often are you going? And what you see is there's half of them are going one or two or three times a month. That is, they're not there every week, but they see themselves as going at least once a month. And maybe they're not going to your church every month either, but they have told us. And why would they be motivated to tell us, lie to us? Mm. Americans tend to go, I want you to see me as a church attender, so I'm going to tick the box. That's been a problem Americans, sociologists have had, because they have that, they want to present as a good citizen as a church attender. Young Australians do not have that that cultural, desire to be seen as a church attender. So when they're telling
us... There's no social kudos or status attached for a young person to be seen falsely as a...
Yeah. So I'm going, why are they lying then on this survey to tell us? So we think that there's more exploration from young adults than perhaps we were expecting. And you're just not seeing them, and you're not paying attention to them when they turn up once a month at your church. You're not paying attention, and you're not understanding that for them, they've counted that as part of their religious expression.
So is part of this potentially a change in relationship with church?
Mm-hmm.
So, the concept, because I could see how, and this probably relates to the lack of religious affiliation and identity piece. So let's say I go to church once a month. For me, in this highly digital networked time, that's a big commitment of my time.
Yes.
I'm not there to become part of a community, because I'm already part of 10 digital communities, and I've got my friends and the life. I'm there to meditate and learn and also... Yeah. So I just wonder if the disjunction might be from an older view of what it means to actually be part of a church.
Yep.
Now, that's not to say that doesn't present challenges when you have these people who are sort of cycling through, and they're not necessarily going to join the parish council or clean the toilets on the Sunday. But I kind of feel this pull myself in a way that this very fragmented world we're a part of now, where you really do have to – it's very common for – everyone to be working and there's constant distraction because you're part of all these online communities. So my first reaction to that is actually the way young people are going to connect with church. And it was that thing that came up in your survey about timely. One of the things that will get them to church is if it's short.
Now, well, I think you're right. I think you're now starting to try and make sense of what we're presenting, rather than go, oh, that's rubbish, you must have got it wrong. And I'm going, well, I've tried it on three different survey waves now, and it's there. It keeps coming up. So are they lying? I'm not going to start there. I'm going to assume. So how do we make sense of what they're telling us? And there's this mix in what they're telling us. They're going, I don't affiliate with your tribe. I don't see I belong to the institution. I'm not Catholic. I'm not Anglican. But I'm going. I'm attending. I'm praying. I'm believing, or I'm open to a level of belief. What they more often do is say, I don't know. So you have less adherence to an Orthodox Christian belief. They certainly don't necessarily say Jesus is divine or Jesus rose from the dead. But in the same way as we see from newcomers, you belong before you believe. So you actually warm into beliefs. That's where the social understanding is really important, rather than have some conversion experience. So as young adults are experimenting and trying, being connecting with faith communities, you know, I say, well, keep your eyes open and find ways for them to belong and connect that are not too overwhelming, not too challenging, but there is a greater, there's a softness that we were surprised by. The group that was most hostile, most disengaged was the 50 to 69s, the Gen Xers who came after the baby boomers. Baby boomers who would have maybe gone when they were, you know, gone to Sunday school and maybe even young adults. The Gen Xers were like the next lot down and just sort of, but when you think about that age group, I guess the question I've raised is, who is holding the microphone at the moment? Who writes the opinion pieces in the newspapers? Who is the thought leaders?
Who controls the public narrative?
Well, it would be people who are currently in that age group. You know, again, it's not sharp-edged, but that age group who, when we look at their religious engagement, least likely to believe, least likely to practice, least likely to feel that religion institutions have a place in society and have a role, and they are the ones that are the loudest at the moment.
And I bet you they're the ones that were running that campaign as well, to tick no on the religion. And so that actually really explains something that I've been wrestling with for a while, because I have sensed, and all of this data and your research bears it out, that there really is this disjuncture between the public narrative on religion and the reality amongst, let's just call them, the common folk. And that perfectly explains it, because there's this one at the bottom of the U-shape. They are the opinion makers and the ones that have a disproportionate influence just because that generates that a certain age group probably always, they tend to be newspaper editors and entrepreneurs and CEOs and senior public officials and politicians. And
it's your stage of life means that when you get to that point, you're at the stage of being the boss, being the manager, the person of influence. Like, we're at the right stage of life. Being in that, you're not retired yet, whereas baby boomers are now starting. It's the late boomers, sorry, I'm going to clarify, because it's the late boomers and Gen X. It's not just Gen X. As a Gen X person, I have to be a little bit protective.
Well, I'm Gen X as well, but I'm not 50 yet, because I'm at the in the sort of mid-70s part of Gen X. So your age group kind of cuts across the older Gen X and the younger boomers.
And it picks up baby boomers. So it's again where I've gone, look, it's just for the sake of this analysis, I'll carve it into four even age groups. But you sort of get that feeling. Again, you're not talking to those who are fully retired, et cetera, but there is that sort of those who are key leaders are going to be...
That's the age group. Yeah, it is. That's the age group our prime ministers
have been
for...
Some
exceptions like the US, but that's a different...
it is.
The US is a bit of an outlier in a lot of...
It is. And I'm not to say... It's like sometimes people think, oh, you're just trying to paint a rosy picture that it's all okay. And I know it's not all okay. You know, they say from their small, declining, uniting church context, and you go, yes, we know that. We know that. We'll come back and go, there are certain parts of the church which have been... We call them the mainstream, you know, they are declining. They are older and declining, and they've got massive challenges. The Pentecostals have been growing and have a different set of massive challenges. And then, you know, that the lack of tolerance of institutional misbehaviour now, young ones, again, going, do not tell me what to do. Do not tell me how to live. But, hey, I'm actually interested in exploring this faith stuff. You know, so it's they will not be told, though, when you ask, should religions... you know, institutions do things in society. Oh, I don't know about that. You know, I've got to be careful. Well, yes, maybe no. It's tough. They sort of, that's how they talk about it. Like, I'm not convinced, but do I want to explore faith? Do I want to connect with a local community of faith? Yeah, I'm actually interested in that. So everything's being deconstructed, but it doesn't mean we are facing an Australian atheistic, fully secularised landscape. I guess that's the we've jumped too far in our assumptions about how bad it all is.
Yeah.
And so
it's a subtle point, really. We're not about to become the French Revolution.
Mm.
Start executing all our priests and,
yes,
come up with this new weird secular pagan religion. Yeah. But nor are we about to have a great awakening, probably. It's something more complex and different in there, which is this openness to Christianity, but not necessarily Orthodox Christianity. Mm. So that is going to present both opportunities and challenges for those in the institutional churches. But, Ruth, we need to bring this to a close. It's been utterly fascinating for me, and I'm sure listeners too. And so I just want to really thank you for the amazing research you do, and for just a masterful tour of the wonderful and thoroughly surprising demographic reality of Christianity and religion in Australia. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.